Hi, this is Paula Morrell, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast. Too small for you. Honey, I must digress. We're singing so long, Miss Carrie Hernandez. How's everybody doing tonight? About tonight's music by Justin McGoldrick. Y'all like Justin and Amy McBride? Yeah. Justin McGoldrick is a self-taught singer, songwriter, and musician raised in Bendigo, Australia. He performs as a solo artist and with his band, the P47s. His album, Calliope Blues, is available on iTunes, Amazon, and Spotify. Also, you can visit him on Facebook or justinmcgoldrick.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Moreau. On my left here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Mark was a featured guitarist for the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Our featured artist tonight is Little Rock mixed media artist Carla McGoldrick with this pinup girl here, this one right here. It's entitled Whisper, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this painting and Carla at cmcgoldrickarts.wordpress.com or on our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern style storytelling? Our riders are all crossing borders, some emotional, some cultural, and some physical. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Holly Patton goes south to the border and the crossing begins. And we'll end the night with George Smith as the border he crosses separates the men from the boys. But let's start the night with Carrie George as she crosses the border between womanhood and motherhood, and she is not prepared in Firstborn.
You are having contractions, the nurse in the emergency room told me. No, I'm not, I replied. I couldn't possibly be having contractions. It was December 27th, and my first child was not due until February 2nd. Besides, I didn't feel like I was having contractions. I wasn't doubled over with pain that I had to breathe through. I wasn't feeling anything, really. I was just having some slight bleeding. And my child was not going to have a birthday 2 days after Christmas. When you are 7 or 8 months pregnant during the holidays, there is no escaping the parallels with the Christmas story. My husband and I had traveled from El Paso, Texas to Milan, Tennessee, his ancestral home, over Thanksgiving. Upon our return to the crowded bustle of the El Paso airport, carrying all of our belongings, my mother had asked if we felt like Mary and Joseph. I remarked that I was just glad we didn't have to travel by donkey. I also got lots of comments on how much I added to the church's Christmas program. At the time, I was a volunteer sign language interpreter in my church, and my colleagues and I had interpreted the Christmas cantata a few days earlier. I have always loved signing the music, especially the Christmas music. There was a song in this program that I particularly liked, Little Yeshua. It was sung by Joseph to the newborn Jesus, and it expressed his wonder and fear at being a new father. People in the church told me that when I held the baby and rocked the baby, they felt like they could actually see it. I thanked them, smiling, because I don't think they meant to refer to my obvious condition. Now, here I was in the hospital where I myself had been born, and where my mother had worked as a surgical nurse for 30 years. In another Christmas parallel, the hospital was located on the side of Mount Franklin, just below the El Paso Electric Company star. Since the 1940s, the electric company had lit a star on the mountain at Christmas time. Made of strings of 150-watt bulbs strung on wires between metal poles and supported by cables, the star could be seen from at least 30 miles away on the ground and from 100 miles away in the air. But this was early on a Saturday morning, and the star was not lit, and I was ready for the emergency personnel to tell me what was going on and let me go home. I had a Christmas tree to take down. Suddenly, the fetal monitor started beeping insistently, and everyone started to move. The baby was in distress. The doctor said something about a cesarean. The nurse asked me questions like, "When was the last time you ate?" as she started rolling the bed I was on towards surgery. "What's happening?" I asked. "We're going to have a baby," my husband replied. If I had any part in making that decision, I don't remember it. Everyone in the room knew and had worked with my mother, and there was no way they were taking any chances with Willene's grandbaby. This was not what I had planned. I wasn't ready. I didn't even have a crib. We were planning to shop the January sales. The ladies at the church and the people in my office were planning baby showers next month. We had barely started childbirth classes. Because the baby was in distress, they didn't offer me any options about partial anesthetic. They just knocked me out. They told me to count backwards from 100, and the next thing I knew, someone was calling my name, waking me up. My firstborn child had been brought forth, and I had missed it. I guess it wasn't quite as bad as giving birth in a stable, but I'm not sure you could have convinced me of that at the time. When my husband tells the story of our daughter's birth, he says that the first thing I asked when I woke up was, "Does she have hair?" This is not true. The first thing I asked was, "Is she in an incubator?" She was not. She was very small, less than 5.5 pounds, but apparently she was ready for the world. As the pediatrician said, "She's tiny, but she doesn't know it." Then I asked if she had hair. She did. My mother said she looked like baby Snow White. Dark hair, fair skin, and rosebud lips. Because they wanted to monitor her status, and because I was still suffering from the effects of the anesthesia, I didn't get to see and hold my daughter until several hours later. When we were finally alone and I was able to hold her and let her nurse, I knew at last how Mary must have felt in that stable. The words of the song from the cantata filled my mind. "Are you a prophet? Are you a king? Or just a small baby who makes angels sing? I'm not a wise man. I need a light to shine on my questions tonight. What can I teach you? A carpenter's trade? The tools and the wood and the way things are made? What will you teach me? Will I understand the mysteries you hold in your hand?" It began to snow. Snow in El Paso during the holidays is not usual, but it's not unheard of. As I sang the song and held my baby in the light of the star on the mountain, I knew that this was a special baby who had much to teach me. Perhaps she was not a prophet or a king, but she would definitely make the angels sing. The universe must have enormous faith in me to entrust me with the care of such a precious gift. As the snow fell and the star shone, I felt the spirit of my great-grandmother with me. How Gano would have loved having another baby to spoil. Her presence seemed to confirm both the specialness of this child and her faith in my ability to be a mother. Since that night, a lot of things have not gone according to plan. I did not plan to be a single parent. I did not plan to move to Arkansas. But the bond that we formed that night has matured and survived and sustained us. And like Mary, I have kept all the wonder and fear and hope and love of that first night and pondered them in my heart.
Carrie George grew up in Texas, went to college in Virginia, and now resides in Arkansas. She is the proud mother of 2 grown children, one of whom insists on living in New York. In our next story, Holly Patton travels to a physical border and ends up crossing a human one in Borders.
I walk in, and the Dave Matthews lyrics go across my brain. Funny the way it is, if you think about it. Somebody's going hungry, and someone else is eating out. Funny the way it is, not right or wrong. The stove is small. It's an old harvest yellow Kenmore with four burners, but only three work. There's nothing fancy here, no commercial stainless steel. Probably a drug lord who's redecorated their house has brought it to the small concrete building and gave it as a donation to the soup kitchen. She stands over the stove like a queen on her throne. Her arms are thick and muscular as she welcomes us into the building. Her whole face wrinkles into a wide, bright smile, and she laughs and greets us. Bienvenidos, amigos, dances out of her mouth. Buenos dias, Madre Irina. The cinder block walls don't make for a warm, welcoming sanctuary. There is no heat, and though we are in the middle of an arid, dry desert land, the December air is bitter cold and soaks deeply into our bones. Madre Irina cuts and chops with a stainless paring knife, mincing carrots, onions, sharply and swiftly. We are piled in bulky layers, grungy old navy t-shirts and gray sweatshirts underneath big button-down shirts, topped with thick, fluffy down coats. We look a whole lot more insulated than we really are in all this strange layer of clothing. But by now, none of us have any desire for fashion, only warmth and function. We are on day three of an ethics class, Faith at the Borders. It has brought all 12 of us to this brutal, barren place, Nogales, Mexico. We look silly and smell funky. Rank body odor wafts around us like the wind that blows out in the desert. There is no clean water, not to mention warm showers or soft towels. A stench permeates and swarms us. But because we are all in the same state and no one can separate the source of the odoriferous offense, no one complains. I never knew that oppression had its own scent. It does. And the 12 of us now emanate faint traces of the capitalism and oppressive systems that we live and participate in. We smell and sense it tangibly. 3 days. For 72 hours now, we have lived in liminal space. We have lived in the squalid, sordid dirt that encompasses the space between the border between the United States and Mexico, us and them, America, and everyone else that we deem unfit. Our day started early at the Mexico Immigration Station. The building is brand new. The halls are vast, echoing, and cold. And yet we sit in the stark, clean offices of the Border Patrol's office and listen to the fat, pot-bellied man talk and swagger. His shiny black boots and big guns glisten as we listen to his accomplishment that he's so eager and proud to share. 12 people just last week captured by the Border Patrol. 2 died. He smiles. Jeeps, sharp fences, and lots of big guns. I can barely hear these words. The heat is on overdrive in this building, and it is hot and oppressive. My stomach tosses and turns. Noxious smells and obnoxious men. But now the day is almost over as we walk into another building. This one is fragrant and drafty. It is a tiny Presbyterian church's sponsored soup kitchen, a sanctuary. The room is lined with long, rectangular metal tables, and they are all filled. Men, boys, weary, wet, and hungry. I see faces who remind me of my sons at home in Arkansas. They can't be more than 17. I taste salt, and I realize that it is from the tears that are falling from my eyes. I can imagine my own sons sitting bloodied, tired and hungry, and their blonde hair and blue eyes weary in a cold concrete building trying to make their way across the desert to a place they believe is filled with bounty and freedom. I'm filled with a deep, heavy despair. as thick as the dried blood on some of their bodies. The floors are worn, chipped gray, but scrubbed clean, and the cold sneaks up into the concrete, just as the scent of onions and peppers now penetrate my long hair. Onions, carrots, chilies, and beans meshing together begin to fragrance the large rectangular room. Jorge, Roberto, Juan. A few of their names I remember. Their faces, arms, and feet, scratched, blistered, and bloody, are seared into my psyche forever. No, no zapatos, he gestures to his feet. We are flummoxed. What? He has lost his shoes, running from the border patrol. Huge, deep, bleeding cuts on his feet and legs with layers and layers of dirt covered the blood. His choice was to continue through the cactus and briars of the desert barefooted, to surrender, or to be shot. He chose to lose his shoes. Through limited words and lots of hand communications and the help of our friend Jonathan, who is our interpreter, we ask what happened. The Border Patrol had pulled their big, shiny guns on them, and the young men had to run for their lives for about 3 miles across the desert full of sharp, ragged thorns and bushes. The dark cacti jab and stab them quickly and silently in the desert. Yet light beams from his eyes. This young man is not defeated. He has no shoes, but he has hope. I take some water and I try to warm it, and I place it in one of the blue bowls that moments before had been filled with Madre Irina's warm bean soup. Carefully, I take a worn dish rag and gently try to wipe away a layer of the thick, crusty blood and dark dirt. Who knew the serene desert could hold such cruelty? One of us has a tube of Neosporin. It's cold as I slather some of the thick gel into and over his raw feet. And then I take rough brown paper towels and wrap his feet. There are no plush terry cloth towels anywhere near us. The pain causes him to flinch, and yet he smiles at me and nods, "Si, si, gracias." Sam sits down in the cold metal chair next to him. Sam stands about 6'4" and is at least 300 pounds. He is bald and black and an unlikely angel, a gentle giant. Sam has worn 2 pairs of white socks early this morning because it had been frigidly cold when we left our bunkhouse before dawn in the morning mist. He takes his socks off and gently places them on Jorge. His size 13 shoes will do Jorge no good, as Jorge is a diminutive man, probably about 5'8". And then Robert pulls off his blue University of Kentucky sweatshirt and gives it to Jorge as Thomas is taking off his brand new Patagonia windbreaker. The smells of garlic, onion, and love hover in the room. We gather and we take each other's hands. I feel the contrast between Belinda's soft, smooth skin in my left hand and the thick, calloused, rough hands of Jorge in my right hand. We sing Vaya con Dios with cold tears dripping down our faces. Tonight, we have crossed all kinds of borders.
Holly Patton is an ordained minister, writer, mother to Rainey and Patton, and grandmother to Addie and Stella. She is at yet another crossroads, trying to decide what she wants to be when she grows up. In our final story of the night, George Smith jumps willingly across a border, leaving boyish things behind in A Moment in Time.
It was 1958, and it was cold. My trusty Schwinn had taken me to a basketball game at the Avery, Texas gym, but halfway home, the chain broke on a down push, trying to get more speed in order to get out of the cold faster. I stashed the bike in some hollyhock bushes behind the Missionary Baptist Church. Not that anybody would steal it, even if I left it in the middle of the road. It was, as stated, 1958, and it was in Avery, population 332. Theft of property was mostly limited to the times when hobos passed through town and jumped off the train, or in a few cases where ancients who took a handful of gumballs at the drugstore and didn't remember doing it or even sucking on the multicolored candies. My daddy, the local pharmacist and champion soda jerk, just made a note on her account, and a relative paid the bill, no questions asked. Avery was that kind of town. As I hoofed it down the street toward home, a VW Bug pulled up alongside. Want to ride home, George? I wasn't into girls much, but noticed right off the small car was full of them. There were three, all high schoolers. The driver was Sarah Gilroy, a tall, lanky, blonde, athletic basketball player. Winona Johnson rode shotgun. She was a snappy-eyed brunette cheerleader who could look sexy simply by yawning. Beulah Faye Garmley, an exotic olive-skinned eye smiler with a pouty mouth and a captivating mole just the left of her upper lip, was in the back seat. I did want a ride home. It was cold. Winona opened the door, eased forward, pulling her seat up to give me room to get in the back seat. Even as skinny as I was, built like a saw blade, and Uncle was fond of saying, it was a tight fit. The back seat was beetle small. My left hip and leg burned where it touched Beulah Faye's. I could have moved over slightly and sat on the small ashtray ledge under the window, but really didn't see the need or, for that matter, have the inclination. The girls were jabbering about the game with conference rival Winona. Sarah accepted praise from Winona for her 20-something points, and Sarah in turn pointed to Beulah Faye's tight defense as a key to the lopsided score. I was ignored, which was fine, because I was concentrating on touching hips and thighs with Beulah Faye. So, George, Beulah Faye said, turning at the waist to face me, ever been kissed by a real woman? My reaction was a normal one for a young tweener among a bevy of good-looking high school girls. I swallowed my tongue. If I had known about testosterone back then, I would have thought, wow, I am testosteroning to beat the band. I tried to answer Beulah Faye's questions, but all that came out were a hairball racking sound. The trio splattered laughter all over the VW's interior, triggering an all-world case of blushes. If there had been enough light, I know it would have looked like an upside-down thermometer. Beulah Faye put her arm around me and pulled me close. It's okay, George. We're just joshing with you. She gave me a little squeeze, which forced my left elbow funny bone deep into her right breast. Humiliation is not that big of a deal. Really, it's not. So, you never answered my question. Have you ever been kissed by a real woman? No, if you don't count relatives at funerals and homecomings or mama's friends who come to the house on Canasta night. Deafening silence slammed around the car's interior like a Super Bowl. Glancing over her right shoulder, Sarah said, "Would you like to?" Winona echoed, "Would you like to?" Bravado emerged from somewhere. This is a joke, right? Beulah Faye leaned more into me and made my elbow happier than it had ever been in my entire life. No, we're not kidding. Would you like to be kissed by a real woman? Breaking into a lust sweat, I screamed, "Yes, Lord, oh yes, yes, yes." "Go ahead, Beulah Faye," Sarah said as she pulled the VW under one of Avery's 13 street lights and adjusted the rearview mirror. Beulah Faye took my head in both hands, looked deeply into my eyes, moved her head slightly toward me, parted her lips slightly, and closed her eyes. My eyes were riveted on that small beauty mark as her lips touched mine. I expected a short peck, a quick release, and gales of laughter from the girls. I was wrong, but I was not disappointed. As Beulah Faye's lips mashed mine against her teeth, I felt something alive crawling into my mouth. I jerked, but she held me firm. This was not okay. Slowly, ever so slowly, my male sense overcame my kid fear, and I realized the live thing was her tongue, and the slithering was more pleasant than appalling. You know, kind of like a Twinkie compared to boiled rutabaga. Coming up for air, she said, "Now you try it, George." She reconnected her lips without any assistance whatsoever from me, since I was paralyzed from my chin to my waist and from my thighs to my toes. Her tongue flickered in and out of my mouth like a spavin moth around a light bulb. She took her own sweet time in licking my lips and touching the roof of my mouth and tongue in turns. Deciding it was time to make my move, I thrust my tongue forward like a bottle rocket. Whoa, slow down, take it easy. It's easier than it looks. Within the space of a minute, with her hands pressing and squeezing for emphasis and movement, not unlike, I later thought, the ministrations of Fred Astaire to Ginger Rogers, I controlled my I gotta impulse and just let my tongue do the heavy lifting. She broke the kiss. Not bad, George. Not bad at all. You're a fast learner. No memories really remain of the short ride home or what was said when I got to the house. I just went to bed and dreamed of being educated in the finer points of kissing Beulah Faye Garmley. I never got to thank her properly until well into my fifth decade of life, when I was invited to be the commencement speaker at Avery High School. I gave a ho-hum speech about life and how you could win any battle if you just blah, 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 blah. And at the end, I mentioned that no one could make it through life without help. I said my life was enriched by six wonderful people: my grandfather, my grandmother, my mother and father, Mrs. Margie Grant, a world-class English teacher who refused to accept anything but the best from her students, and Beulah Faye Garmley, who taught me how to French kiss. I am a better person because of their efforts on my behalf. Beulah Faye, by this time, a gray-haired grandmother, was in the audience. From all accounts, she looked rather pleased to be included in that esteemed group.
George Smith is a former newspaper editor and communications executive. He has had 6 books published, with 5 more in the works. Tonight's story is from his soon-to-be-published book, Growing Up Mostly Happy. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to UALR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Stitcher, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. We are currently open for submissions from Southerners. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Writer accommodations provided by Robinwood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.